Good morning and welcome to the September 16th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, and a little bit of a crisp morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Park City.
We're going to have a really interesting show today. Our first guest is David Rubenstein. He's been on the show before. He talked about his last book on investing. Rubenstein was the founder of the Carlyle Group. He is actually owns the Baltimore Orioles. He's a fascinating figure. And the thing is, if you're David Rubenstein, you sort of get to talk to some really interesting people in terms of preparing this book, including a number of former presidents. We really enjoyed recording that interview. That'll be coming up in just a minute. Kevin, what else are we doing this morning?
Well, we've got a few other people. We have David Rockwood and Ben Worley from Spiro Carbon. They do carbon offsets. We're going to learn a little bit more about exactly what a carbon offset is and how it could help your organization. And who else do we have? We have Kevin Dineen. He's with Moterra Luxury Camper Van Rentals. We're going to see exactly what that is. But let's hear from David Rubenstein.
In November 2022, we were fortunate to have David Rubenstein join us on Mountain Money to describe his book, How to Invest. Now, Rubenstein has a new book out on the American presidency, The Highest Calling. We're pleased to welcome him back to the program this morning. Good morning, David, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, the book has a remarkable structure in that it features a number of interviews of noted scholars and living presidents. How long have you been interested in the presidency, and what motivated you to structure the book in that fashion?
Well, when I was a little boy, I saw John Kennedy drive past my neighborhood in his car on his way to an event, and he was campaigning for president. So ever since that time, I've probably been interested in the presidency. And as a young man, I wanted to work in the White House, and I was very fortunate to work for President Carter for 4 years in the White House. And since that time, I've lived in Washington. And so when you live in Washington, you tend to get to know people work on White House staffs, and I get to know the presidents, and I've known all the presidents since Jimmy Carter, some better than others, and some I've worked with more closely than others, but I've just had a fascination with the White House and the presidency, I guess.
Outstanding. Now, you start with a chapter on George Washington. How significant was his role in defining the nature of the U.S. government?
Well, had Washington not agreed to be president, he didn't want to be president because no male member of his family had ever lived past 50, and he was 57 at the time. He didn't think he had long to live. But he agreed to do it, and he didn't really like the job, and after a couple of months, he was going to quit, but he was talked into staying, and then he didn't want to get reelected, but he was talked into doing a second term, and finally, after the second term, he said, I'm out of here. I think he set the tone. He made it not a royal kind of job. People thought that he should be called Your Majesty, Your Highness. But he said, no, just call me Mr. President. And that's the title that we still have for the President of the United States. He was not a poor man. He was a wealthy man. But he wanted to kind of have an image of the presidency as being somebody that was accessible to people. And so he made himself available to people. People could come to meet with him from time to time. And I think he set the tone for the presidency. And I think some of the things he innovated and did at the time that were unique were things we still do today.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, for example, of course, resigning after two terms is one example. But he also, he did consult with Congress on appointments and things like that, as members do. And he did obey the advise and consent, the provisions of the Constitution. He honored them, even though from time to time he was frustrated with it. He did tend to want to know people in the country, so he spent time visiting all parts of the country, which people are present still do. He did spend time socializing in Washington because he thought that that's the best way to know other people and can give people his views were to be the social. So he was quite social in that respect. And he remember, there's no television, no radio. So if you want to get your views out, you had to socialize with people, and he was willing to do that. I think he was a president who really set the tone for a lot of other presidents that have come along, which is to say, be informed about things, be a leader, but be modest and humble to some extent. And while all of our presidents weren't that way, I think many of the most admired presidents have had a certain amount of humility to them.
You know, you mentioned the two-term decision. In the 18th century, I suspect that that was critically important in sort of distinguishing between the concept of a constitutional republic and a monarchy. And that tradition lasted a long time. Is that your sense as well, that decision not to stay on after two terms was very important in terms of defining the role of the presidency?
Well, at the Constitutional Convention, some people like Alexander Hamilton thought the president should stay forever. The Constitution did not put a term limits in, and so now we have term limits, but that was not the time. And George Washington was somebody who wanted to make certain that we didn't have a king. So that's why he didn't really want to stay forever, or did he not want anybody in his family to succeed him? There was never any discussion of that. But he could have said, look, I want somebody in my family to succeed me, or I want to stay until I die. But he didn't do that. And I think we give him a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. Now, so you mentioned that he's on the road, traveling around, meeting people. About what percentage of the time would you say he would be traveling around the country to meet people?
Well, remember, at the time he was president, he was president in New York and then Philadelphia. Those were the capitals of the country. He did actually select the site there. The capital now is Washington, D.C., as we call it. But it was his decision to locate it there. He felt that he should visit all parts of the country that he was the president of, and so he did spend time. And it wasn't that easy in those days. They didn't have jet airplanes or railroads, so we had to go by horseback, more or less. And he was a skilled horseman, but still, took a long time. It could take a couple of weeks to go from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. by horseback.
Many of the chapters focus on particular elements of a presidency. I think you mentioned in the book that there have been some 16,000 books written on Abraham Lincoln. You interviewed
right.
Ted Widmer, who wrote an entire book on a 13-day trip from Springfield to Washington.
Right.
Why was that trip so important, and what does it tell us about the unique challenges faced
by
Lincoln?
Well, many books about Lincoln are well-known and have been around for a long time. Doris Kearns Goodwin did a terrific one on Lincoln, and obviously Carl Sandburg did another famous one. There are lots of great books about him. But this is one that I read where I didn't know much about it before, and I thought many other people didn't either. And what it's about is the trip that Lincoln took from Springfield to get to Washington, D.C., very circuitous route. He had to go on the circuitous route because he had to avoid going to the Confederate States because they might have assassinated him. And there was an assassination plot that he had to worry about when he went through Baltimore. But he made speeches. He got identified he helped identify himself to people more because most people had never seen him before. He was a relatively unknown person. And so he made speeches in lots of interesting cities and made speeches at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, made a major speech in New York and smaller cities. And he met a lot of famous people during the time of that trip. And I thought it was an unusual story that I hadn't been that familiar with. I thought other readers would enjoy it as well.
And what did he communicate during those speeches? This is obviously a fraught time for the Republic. How is he setting the tone for his upcoming administration?
Well, remember that some Southern states had already seceded. So he was trying to say, I haven't done anything that should make the South worried. He was not an abolitionist. He did not believe in abolishing slavery. His view at that time was that slavery had already been in the Constitution, and so it had to be left alone. His view was that in new states that were going to join the Union, they should not have slavery in them. That was very upsetting to the Southern states because they thought that eventually they would be surrounded by states that did not have slavery, and eventually those states would overwhelm them in the Congress and so forth, and slavery would eventually be eliminated. That's why they were so upset with Lincoln, because he didn't want slavery in the new states, and they thought eventually that would come to take away their livelihood as well, the people who were the slave owners. But Lincoln ultimately came around to the need to get rid of slavery, and he did that through the Emancipation Proclamation. But that was really done as much to win the war as anything else, because it enabled about 200,000 freed slaves to fight for the Union, which they did.
One of the details that caught my eye was the concept that at one of those speeches, apparently John Wilkes Booth was present. Hello, did I lose you?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry, David. One of the details that caught my eyes was apparently a notation that John Wilkes Booth was actually present at one of those early speeches.
John Wilkes Booth was one of the speeches. He was an actor, and he was at one of the speeches that Lincoln gave on his trip to Washington, D.C. And actually, John Wilkes Booth was at another occasion, I think right before Lincoln was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, after the 13th Amendment, had been approved by the Senate, the House, and it was then going to go to the states for ratification. Lincoln gave us a little talk at the White House in front of people, and he said something to the effect that he thought maybe it would be the case that some educated freed slaves would be eligible to vote. Not everybody who was a freed slave, but some educated ones or certain appropriate ones. That so upset John Wilkes Booth that he resolved right then that he had to assassinate Lincoln, because he didn't think that former slaves should ever have the right to vote, let alone any other rights.
And at that time, Booth was the most popular actor in America. Is that right?
Yes. His father and his brother were extremely popular actors, and John Wilkes Booth was also a very popular actor, a very skilled Shakespearean actor. And that it was his ability to as an actor that was so well known that when he went to Ford Theater that night, he could get through normal security guards because people just thought he was there as part of his career. Interestingly, as I pointed out in the book, Lincoln invited Ulysses S. Grant to go with him to the Ford Theater that night, but Mrs. Grant did not like Mrs. Lincoln, felt he was very difficult to deal with, so they came up with an excuse that they had to be out of town, which they did. They went to New Jersey by train, and so therefore the entire military entourage that would have accompanied Ulysses S. Grant to Ford Theater was not there, and therefore John Wilkes Booth had an easy entry into the balcony that Lincoln was sitting at. So we'll always wonder if John Wilkes Booth had not been able to get in, would Lincoln have survived? How would the country have been different? How would Reconstruction have been different? Obviously, we'll never know the answers to that.
Yeah, indeed. What made Lincoln so special that he was able to successfully navigate the Civil War?
Lincoln had a certain humility about him. He didn't brag about things. He had a certain sense of humor. He realized he came from a very modest background, and he didn't brag about things and so forth. He didn't run around the White House saying, look, I just won the Civil War. Aren't I great? Or I gave the Gettysburg Address. Isn't that a great speech? Very modest, good sense of humor. But he also was willing to listen to other people, and he didn't think he knew all the answers. And so he didn't have an arrogance that you might have brought to the table if you were president of the United States. So I think he had a lot of great skills, and you know, he was killed at the young age of 56 years old. That's it, 56.
We could probably talk about Lincoln for the rest of the time we have together, but let's move on to Woodrow Wilson. He had an unlikely and crazy meteoric rise to the presidency. He obviously hoped the League of Nations would be a signature achievement, but then his health problems happened. What happened, and how did the government function?
Well, what happened was that Woodrow Wilson was only served 2 years as governor of New Jersey and got elected president of the United States after just 2 years as governor of New Jersey. So that's an amazing rise, you might say. Secondly, when he was elected president, he was seen as a progressive, a liberal Democrat. But he had some Southern roots, and the result was he was very interested in resegregating the workforce in the federal government. But what you're referring to is that he had a stroke. He was trying to get the League of Nations approved as part of the Treaty of Versailles. He wanted to get Congress to approve the League of Nations, his idea of the kind of equivalent of the UN. And he went on a railroad trip around the country. During that time, he suffered a stroke, and he later had another more severe stroke. And he basically was incapacitated physically for 18 months of his presidency, the last 18 months. So he had his wife, more or less, serving as the de facto president, because she was reviewing the papers that came to him, and she was deciding what he should see and not see, and probably she was making some decisions for him. So it was a very unfortunate situation because, you know, we didn't elect her president of the United States. She didn't really have any government background at all. And so she was making decisions. And I think as a result of that stroke and the way Wilson handled it and the result of his resegregating the federal workforce, he is not considered the great president that he once was considered. And in fact, the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton has been renamed. They've taken the name off, and some other things that were named after Wilson are no longer named after him.
One of the details that I had never heard before was this image of Wilson trying to deceive legislators who come to see him by, you know, accentuating the one side of his body that could function. What kinds of things did he do to try to convince people that he was still in control?
Well, when he would invite, very rarely, but he'd have members of Congress, a few members of Congress would deign to ask if they could see him from time to time, just to make sure they could tell their constituents, yes, they've met the president and this is what he wants to do. Or sometimes occasionally his cabinet officers would be asked to see him to make sure they knew what he wanted. Mrs. Wilson would prop him up in the bed and kind of make him look like, by putting pillows in the right direction and having the light in the right direction or not having light in certain areas, it would look like he could function and like he could move his body when in fact he really couldn't move his body very much at all. And so it was very deceptive, and it's unfortunate that it happened, but that was the case.
Did he really contemplate running for a third term?
In the book that I interviewed the author of, Scott Berg, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, he did speak about it, but nobody took him seriously who knew his health situation. So he talked about it. Maybe it was just because he was so out of touch with reality that he talked about it. So I don't think it was ever really seriously entertained that he would run for a third term.
Yeah. Now, Jonathan Darman argues that FDR's polio was fundamental to the development of his character. How did he contract the disease, and how do you think it affected his development as a leader?
Roosevelt had a family compound in Campobello, which is a little island off the coast of Canada, honestly. It's not really in the United States. The family had a vacation there for many years. He contracted it maybe at a Boy Scout event that he went to where he was in the water and maybe contracted it there. It's not quite clear where he contracted it. But the first signs of polio came when he was at Campobello, where he couldn't really walk so well. His legs were hurting him, and he kind of just felt he needed more rest. For 30 days, he wasn't getting really good medical treatment, and people didn't know what he had. But when they finally figured it out that it was polio, it was too late to really correct the problem. Had it been known as polio in the first day or two of his contracting it, it's possible that they could have it could have made it possible for him to walk again. But because his legs became so weakened after 30 days, he was never able to walk again, even though he tried to give the appearance that he could. But the Jonathan Darman's thesis is that Roosevelt was not all that gifted intellectually and wasn't taken seriously as a leader by many of his peers, and therefore probably not likely to ever be president of the United States. But by contracting polio, he developed a tougher character. He developed more resilience. He developed more of ability of fighting for something. And as a result, he was willing to take on the challenge of getting elected governor of New York and then president of the United States. So his thesis, which may have some merit to it, is that the polio, while it's a terrible thing for Roosevelt himself to have had it, it no doubt made him stronger than he would have otherwise been and probably wouldn't have been president or a successful president had he not had polio.
And how do you think historians will view his term as president in terms of importance?
I'm sorry.
How do you think historians will view his terms as president in terms of importance?
Roosevelt?
Yes.
Well, Roosevelt served for president longer than anybody else, and he did two things that were really essential to the country. He got us out of the Depression, which Herbert Hoover was unable to really do, and he helped win the Second World War. He died before the war was truly won in near Europe or in Asia, but he pretty much had the pieces in place, and so Truman really was following up on what Roosevelt had done. Roosevelt will be certainly considered by all historians as one of the most significant persons to ever have been president. Remember, he was president for a little bit more than 12 years. Nobody else had ever done that. And getting us through the Depression and World War II, I don't think anybody else had to face so issues so consequential as those were. And so I think Roosevelt will certainly go down in the panoply as one of the greatest presidents we ever had.
Yeah. Now, how did, moving on to Kennedy, how did JFK handle the two big crises of his presidency, A, the Bay of Pigs, and B, the Cuban Missile Crisis?
The Bay of Pigs was an effort by former Cuban citizens to take back control of the government. It had been started by the CIA, and Eisenhower had known about it when he was president, but he never actually gave the approval to do it. When Kennedy became president, he basically was asked to approve it, and he, feeling that he couldn't go against what Eisenhower had presumably, he thought, wanted, and what the CIA had developed, so he went along with it. But he realized pretty readily that it was a disaster afterwards, and he went on TV and said, "I take full responsibility." Ever since that time, presidents have done that. Why? When they make a big mistake. Because when you take responsibility, his polling went up. In other words, Kennedy did a terrible thing. He didn't know what he was doing. He didn't provide the air cover that the Cuban rebels wanted. But his popularity went up when he took the responsibility for it. Ever since then, politicians have said, well, I'm going to take responsibility. Maybe my popularity will go up as a result. But the thing that he did that was really good. And, of course, what people say is, I take responsibility. but I really wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. They hope their popularity go up, but they really don't want to get blamed. many times that has worked, but sometimes it doesn't. But what he really did that was the most brilliant thing in his presidency was when missiles were put into Cuba, nuclear missiles, he was able to, over a 13-day period of time, figure out a way to get Khrushchev to back down and take the missiles away. However, it wasn't a perfect situation. We didn't realize it at the time, but the strategic intercontinental missiles, the nuclear-tipped intercontinental missiles that Khrushchev dissembled and took back, he did not take back the tactical nuclear weapons that were still in Cuba, which we didn't know about at the time. Oh. We learned about it later. And those tactical nuclear weapons were withdrawn later only because Khrushchev had the view that Castro was unreliable and crazy, and therefore he didn't want Castro to have the ability to use those weapons. But it wasn't because we did the Cuban Missile Crisis so well. So, but not leaving that aside, Kennedy was able to talk us down from a nuclear confrontation. I remember as a boy, I was in school, and I can't believe this now, but my teacher said, "I don't think we're going to be here tomorrow because we're going to have a nuclear weapon going off in our country, and therefore there's no homework." It's hard to believe that the teacher would say that, but I distinctly remember saying no homework. So, and I also remember as a boy, because we were worried about nuclear bombs going off and maybe in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we were practicing sitting under our desk. I don't know if you guys are probably old enough to remember this, but you were supposed to practice getting under your desk as if a nuclear weapon, when it went off, would not have radiation that would kill you.
Exactly. That provided some security.
The book is The Highest Calling. It's a remarkable book. David Rubenstein, I wish we had more time to talk about it. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoy your day.
And we're back. This morning we have David Rockwood and Ben Worley from Spiro Carbon. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Thank you very much for
Good
being
morning.
Here. You guys have very cool intro music.
Custom
I'm an old jazz guy.
Custom made. So Spiro Carbon, yeah, David, we talked about it. And can you please give us an idea? What is Spiro Carbon?
Well, basically what we are is we're a climate tech company. And what we do is we help small shareholder farmers to be able to qualify for global standard carbon credits. And what we do with our technology is we use satellite imaging, cell phone imaging, and ground sensors, and all of that data goes into the cloud where our proprietary AI is able to do analytics, and we're able to prove that farmers or other people involved in climate are actually following protocols to qualify. So I'm kind of the KPMG of climate.
So let's take a step back. For the as a financial show, we like to understand sort of the financial rubric that we're dealing with. You started talking about qualifying for offset tax credits. What are those?
So in the world today, there you have emitters of CO2, methane, et cetera, that are causing global warming. Okay, and there are actions that are helping to fight global warming or those CO2 emissions or methane emissions. And so you reward those sources that are cutting methane or cutting CO2, okay, with financial payments that some of the bigger emitters, okay, are creating. So some people refer to it as indulgences, back in the old days of the Catholic Church.
I'm buying the right to pollute, basically, is what you're saying.
Well, but what it is, though, is it's still a positive action.
Okay.
So what I've learned in the climate business is you are the guy with people with 100 arrows shooting at you. Okay, you have climate extremists, you have climate advocates, and you have climate change didn't happen or doesn't happen. Okay, you have a full spectrum there. So that's why we use our technology to verify that, especially what we concentrate on most is a small rice farmer in Asia did change his cultivation practice rather than flooding the whole time. He does alternative flood, alternative dry, alternative flood, alternative dry. And it cuts the methane emissions. When that rice is flooded, there's a biodigestion happening. And in that biodigestion is methane output. So rice is one of the worst contributors of nature-based methane.
Huh. I did not know that.
Nobody knows that. That's why we do what we do.
So when he or she adopts a different process, you're there to capture the fact that that process is different. Who's on the other side of the financial transaction?
So first of all, it needs to be verified, and right. That's what we do. So technically, we're called a digital MRV, Monitoring, Reporting, and Verification Technology Provider. So there are all kinds of projects. It might be Shell Oil. It might be the Gates Foundation. Okay, so that's why we were asked to present at the World Economic Forum in Davos, a small Park City tech company. We were invited to speak there at SDG Labs. We were also invited to speak by the at COP28 in Dubai, by the Space Agency of United Arab Emirates, because our technology does that. So on that other side, as you were asking, are these bigger funds? Okay, or other organizations that are trying to offset their carbon footprint. So also part of what we do is help measure your carbon footprint as well.
Okay.
And I'd like to just add one other group in there that's very important are those bigger companies in that supply chain, so within that agricultural supply chain. Not necessarily looking at carbon offsets, but you have what are called scope 3 emissions. And these are the emissions that you are responsible for outside of your direct control. So someone that's either upstream or downstream from you that has a carbon emission that you are responsible for, if there is a reduction there that you financially contribute to that reduction, you can actually help claim some of that reduction off of your internal carbon footprint, and that's called a carbon inset. And so those companies, so in this case, the fertilizer company or the rice company who's selling the rice to the retailers, they would be the customer that is paying the farmer for that change in practice. And there could be any number of reasons that they're doing that, whether it's consumer-driven or regulatory-driven or tax-driven, that's the financial driver for them to want to do that.
Okay, so the farmer, let's go back to him. Do you put a sensor or something on his property to monitor the methane, or do you just know it's happening by his irrigation dry?
Yeah, so we follow a global standard. It's called the Clean Development Mechanism, and it was instituted by the UN Framework on Climate Change that specifically sets a standard for methane reduction in rice. And we use multiple sources of data collection. We have a mobile application that the farmer has on their smartphone, because even these, you know, smallholder farmers in central Thailand and Vietnam have smartphones. And they use that to capture images that they submit through the mobile app to us. And then we have secondary sources of data, which are different types of satellite, multispectral and synthetic aperture radar satellite data that provides us a secondary source of that data verification to do that. And then we apply that against that clean development mechanism equation to be able to determine how much, quantify the amount of methane that was avoided based on the different variables that we're measuring. So length of cultivation, the total area size, how many times they did that cycle of flooding and drying and flooding and drying that Dave was just talking about.
Basically, it's an audit. Well, okay.
and you guys have been really clear in sort of explaining what I would call the farmer side, that is who your client is. I'm still a little fuzzy, and it's probably me, on who's on the other side of the transaction. What are the range of payers? You know, why would I want to do this if I'm the farmer? I can establish that I've cut it. Who's going to give me money for that?
Okay. Yeah.
There's two. Our, and just to be clear, our customers are actually not the farmers. So we have two types of customers with this. The farmers we work with is our supply. So you think of them as like the source of supply of what we're providing. So the two our two customer types are what we call the producers, which are the carbon credit or carbon offset producers. So these are carbon project developers. So these are guys who come in and they develop these projects to create carbon credits speculatively, right? So it's an asset that they're creating that then they're going to go out and take into the market to sell in either the voluntary markets or the compliance markets, because there are these two different types of markets where these assets are being sold, either for compliance purposes, like in the EU, out in California, they have one. In different markets, they have these and they have different thresholds for that. And then they have the voluntary markets, which are at a much lower price point, that are being sold. And there's dozens of those around the world. So you have these project developers or governments also that are creating carbon credits to be sold or used for different things. So that's the producers. Mm-hmm. So that's their motivation, is to create something that they are going to then sell for a profit. So that's the kind of speculative side. That's one set of customers. The others are the users, who are the ones that are creating, that need to reduce their carbon footprint internally. And that's being done, it's being driven either because of a regulatory or tax purpose, or it's being done because there is consumer pressure for them to do that. And they're either doing that through the use of insets, which is what we were talking about earlier, where they reduce that within their supply chain, or because they want to apply a marketing label. So think like non-GMO, organic, you know, you pay a little bit more for products that have those labeling on it. You're going to start seeing more and more products that are labeled sustainably sourced, low carbon, you know, X, low carbon, whatever. And there will be a premium attached to that. So more and more products are going to have that kind of labeling on it. But what you're not going to see is consumers are not going to just trust that, you know, if it says it's low carbon, that it's low carbon. There's going to have to be some sort of verification that can be traced back to the project to make sure that it actually complies with whatever standards are there. So those are the two paying sides that are paying the farmer for that activity, and we sit as the middle section to verify that, to ensure that the activity actually happened, so that the transaction is fair and transparent and there's a record of the activity actually happening.
Another thing too I wanted to bring up for my local Park City buddies is we are primarily a B2B, okay, as that third party verifier. But we started a B2C version. If you go to offsetski.com, you can purchase a carbon offset against your day of skiing directly. And 70 to 80% of that money goes direct to that farmer. Okay? So if you go to offsetski.com, you can do a carbon offset of that super powder day that you had here in Park City.
And how does that price compare to the price of a Deer Valley lift ticket?
Oh, okay. So if you're a Park City local and you drove to the ski area, it's $5. If you flew here, it's $20. Okay, because and these are all based upon protocols of what the typical carbon footprint is. And we added that because we had so many people approach us. It's like, well, I want to get involved, but I'm not Microsoft. I'm not the Bill Gates Foundation. I'm not whatever. I said, well, hell, let's just do, offset. We also have offset ski, or we also have offset golf to offset your day of golf. We also have offset eats to offset a particular meal that you have as well. So these are B2C. We don't make money at this. It's just more ways to support the farmer, because we're primarily a B2B. And that's why on your show with money, you know, we're primarily providing socially conscious carbon offsets for corporates.
So the I'm going to go back to that farmer. So they're getting paid.
Right.
From someone who's burning coal or something like that. And they, but there's a premium on the rice that they're making, aren't they? Does this?
Well, that's part of what we're doing. So okay. When you have a third-party verifier, so just like when you go buy organic vegetables, okay,
right,
they were certified by a third party that they were truly organic. What we are doing is that same thing. We are verifying that the rice from farmer XYZ in Vietnam, Thailand, whatever, did do alternative wet dry processing, which we can tell through all of our imaging analytics. And yes, he did produce low carbon rice. So they can now put a sticker that says low carbon rice verified by Spirocarbon.
So it's
but typically it's an either or. Right. Either claiming the carbon credits for it or they're doing it as a marketing label. It's not both, because then you get into double counting. Yep. Situation where you're trying to claim both benefits, and so you know we have to be very careful that doesn't happen. And so because we put all of our projects on blockchain and the results of that, you can see whether a project was used for a carbon credit or marketing label.
One of the most unique things, just one last point, is we do everything transparent, okay? There are other verifiers out there in the world, but they don't show their work. So I'm like that math professor where you had to show your work, okay? And again, the contracts we do are NFTs, so they're totally transparent, and everything on blockchain, which is transparent. So that's why we've had such an uptake, is because these guys are like showing everything, so we're anti-greenwashing because you can go check it.
And you have a proprietary AI that runs this whole thing, I think.
Exactly.
I read. And who created that?
Ben?
Really?
Myself and we have a technical co-founder, Dr. Akbet Magoob, who is a brilliant AI engineer. He and I have worked together for the last 11 years on different projects, and we developed the idea, designed, and developed it all in-house.
And it talks to blockchain?
Yes. Yeah, the entire system is fully automated, it's a really cool system.
We are the low-cost provider of third-party verification. So, again, I'm an enterprise software guy. Most of the people in your audience knew me as Rock, the ski rep, for the first 20 years in the 80s and 90s. And then I became a tech guy in 2000s when I started working for World Trade Center Utah and U.S. Department of Commerce. But that's the thing, is we are a low-cost provider. We let our automation do this verification that is standardized, that is legit, and that you can check my work like your math professor.
Okay, quickly before we go, Spirocarbon, where'd you come up with the name?
Well, there's the Spiro Tunnel. And what's interesting, too, is as you look around the world, it's pronounced about three different ways. So we have Spiro, we have Spiro, and all kinds of things.
And what about the mine?
Scott Lessing, Spiro in Latin or Greek means to breathe. So that's the highbrow answer.
Interesting.
We're talking about helping the world to breathe better.
So that is what. So there was nothing about the mine tunnel that influenced it.
It has something to do with it.
Okay.
Because I live here.
Okay. If people want to learn more about the company, what's your website? How can they learn more?
Spirocarbon.com, and we have a YouTube channel. That's probably the best way to educate what we do, because in a video, you could recheck it and watch it a few times, and we appreciate that opportunity.
Okay, we've been speaking with David Rockwood and Ben Worley of Spirocarbon. Gentlemen, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, and go Miners.
We'll be right back after this.
And we are back, and we have Kevin Dineen from Moterra Luxury Camper Van Rentals. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you guys.
Thank you for coming. Can you give us a brief description of your background and how it played into your rental business?
Yeah, so the business story really starts with us as people. It's me and two other co-founders that started the company. We all grew up, two of us grew up together, me and Gabe, grew up in Montrose, Colorado, and on the Western Slope, in a place where I like to say that outdoor recreation was really bred into us from an early age. So, and the same was true for Trevor. He grew up in California, in a beautiful part of the foothills. And we really are very lucky to have grown up in places where we had incredible opportunities to get outdoors all the time. And as we effectively moved on into our careers, we wanted to create an opportunity to help other people do the same thing. And that was kind of the origin story of what, you know, what inspired us to begin working on Moterra.
Nice. And did your finance background help you get funding for the startup? Because I see that you were in finance.
Yeah. We actually, so I spent a decade in venture capital prior to this and in the climate tech space. And I'd done a couple other things prior to that. But we actually haven't raised any venture money for Moterra. So it's been very helpful thinking about how to structure the growth of our business. It is capital intensive. Our vans are very expensive units that require a lot of money to get out on the road. But so it has been really helpful. So I kind of came at it with a professional background, professional finance background, and Gabe and Trevor had both spent a bunch of time as professional guides. So we make a great team.
So Kevin, had you gone into a venture capitalist, and Kevin and I were the two guys sitting on the other side of the room, and you wanted to explain this business model, how would you describe what you guys do?
Yeah. Well, the product itself is twofold. Our core product is luxury camper van rentals. So we have a fleet of, right now it's about 70 vans that are available for rent in seven different states. So we've got, they're all top of the line Mercedes Sprinter vans. They're all upfitted. We have three different models that are kind of cater to different groups and have slightly different amenities, but they all offer the same great experience. So the kind of core, and that's where we started, was just offering vans for rent. So if you're interested in traveling somewhere where we have a location, you can fly in, or if you're local, you can just come down and pick up a van and take it on an adventure of your own choosing. That has kind of evolved. We you know, obviously that's the kind of core of what we do, but we also offer a secondary product, which we call itineraries, which are kind of pre-planned itineraries, which if you are either too busy or you're a little bit intimidated or you just really want expert advice to make sure that you only have a weekend or a week in to go see somewhere that you haven't been before and you want to kind of squeeze everything out of the experience, you can purchase one of our itineraries. And if you do that, we pair you up with somebody, a dedicated writer that you're going to be interacting with, or a kind of an expert, and they will be your Sherpa, making sure that you get all, we take care of all the campground bookings, all the kind of activity recommendations and bookings if they're required, and anything else from the local coffee shop that you need to go and get a beignet here, or kind of one of the taglines that we use is we want to help people travel like a local, because, we know we've all had experiences where we kind of have the inside track, and almost anywhere you can go and have an amazing time if you know what you're doing and you kind of know the program. And we've all had the opposite experience where we're kind of a couple steps out of touch with just about everything. And despite all the time and energy and money that goes into planning these trips, sometimes it just doesn't quite click. And we really want to, this itinerary product is kind of you can think about it as an insurance policy to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Concierge camping.
Exactly.
Beautiful. So how long have you guys been around?
Yeah, we 8 full years of operation. We started working on the concept in 2016, and 2017 was our first year of operations. And
in how many locations?
7 now. So we started, in Jackson Hole, and now we operate. I can list them all out, but Jackson Hole is where we started. Salt Lake City is our local operation here in Utah. We're in Vegas. We're in San Francisco. We're in Seattle, Washington, and we're in Whitefish, Montana, right outside of Glacier National Park. So those 6 kind of comprise the kind of Rocky Mountain West, and then we actually launched in Portland, Maine, on the East Coast last year as well. So we're increasingly have a national footprint.
It's a huge capital investment, though. I mean, I'm thinking about that many Sprinter vans. How did you put together your funding?
Yeah. Effectively, early on, it was it started very humbly. So we, you know, the first year of operation was one van, and so, you know, so we had the means to fund the first
self-funding.
Yeah, exactly. So the first several years were self-funding, and we have taken a bootstrapped approach. We've been profitable since the first year. So basically, what we did is in the early years, we weren't paying ourselves anything, and now we pay ourselves a little, but effectively, we're the business, every dollar of cash that the company would operate, we would pour into growing the fleet and the operation the next year. We did that for 3 or 4 years, and then basically the growth of the growth trajectory outstripped our ability to self-fund it. So we have set up... we basically have a funding structure where we do have some outside investments. It's not classic venture capital, but basically we can offer, we're offering a kind of diversified, an investment into a diversified set of vans. So so we have taken some money to help fund that. We work with banks who provide a huge part of the money that we use. But yeah, so that's the long and the short of it.
7 locations now. How many do you expect to have by the end of 2025?
We're not sure. We're kind of in this mode. So we started. We started small, and kind of grew this regional footprint. We grew that very rapidly, and our geographic strategy historically, or our geographic expansion has always kind of outstripped the number of vans in the fleet. And that requires us to be very creative, kind of moving things around and only in certain cases having seasonal availability. And over the last couple of years, that combined with COVID was obviously an incredible force for our business. It was a huge accelerant. And so our business accelerated really dramatically, basically from inception until this year. We started to kind of prioritize taking our foot off of the gas pedal from a growth perspective, both in terms of fleet expansion, but also regional expansion, to really refine what we have already and make sure that we've got just a super strong foundation. There certainly will be more growth, but to answer your specific question, I'm not sure that we will have any new locations by the end of 2025. It's possible. There are certainly a whole bunch of markets that we have our eyes on where we imagine the Motera, or we know the Motera concept would work very well, but it's just kind of a matter of priorities at the moment. So
I'm visualizing infrastructure. You're renting out vans. There's cleaning, there's mechanical. Do you set up your own sort of shops in each of these locations, or do you do some outsourcing? Talk to us about how you make this thing work as a practical matter.
Yeah, it is really a business where we are just, you know, dealing with nonstop logistics, whether it's client logistics and pickup and drop off times and, you know, kind of like the specific accommodations that people are looking for to make their trips work well. Or, you know, on the back end, all of the, you know, vehicle detailing and van maintenance. And, you know, these are complicated assets with lots of moving pieces.
Literally.
And both mechanically and electronically, there's a lot going on. So we don't set up we work with some great Mercedes you know dealerships. So we get them all. We try to outsource as much as possible. We're big believers that narrow and deep is a better kind of business focus than trying to be too shallow and too wide. So we don't do like, you know, tires and chassis maintenance and all the like the basic vehicle functions. That's almost exclusively like outsourced to people that do that all day, every day, and can make sure that our, you know, clients are safe and that we can sleep at night and all those good things. But there is a ton of, maintenance that's required on things that like Mercedes wouldn't know what to do. We buy Mercedes cargo vans, and then we work with a great upfitter called Field Vans in California. They, you know, turn a cargo van into this incredible RV effectively. And there's a ton of componentry in there that, you know, you can imagine in a rental use case. We are very lucky to have incredibly respectful renters, and we have zero horror stories after 8 years,
really?
Which is,
really?
I'll knock on wood
incredible.
As I say that. But even so, it's people that aren't familiar, and just things happen over time. And so there's a kind of a nonstop or an ongoing repair log that we just try to be as diligent as possible about tracking everything going on and you know addressing it as quickly as possible. But it's a huge amount of
And I assume you do basic housekeeping in-house.
Yeah.
The changing of the sheets. The cleaning, the basic details.
Yeah, all of the detailing and housekeeping is done internally. So anything that's kind of directly client-facing, that's kind of, in the narrow and deep analogy, that's where we focus our energy. Yeah, and everything else, we try to work with people who are specialized.
So if you have no proposed growth right now, what about franchising? Will you franchise out to some people?
That's possible. That is one thing that a lot of the work that we're doing right now to kind of like refine our processes and you know, it's exactly the same work stream that we haven't made a decision to franchise, but we look at it as it's the exact same work stream that we need to be doing, whether we're going to continue expanding with the corporate owned model or if we're going to begin franchising. We need to really, like, we have a lot of, after 8 years, a lot of solid processes and a lot of kind of know-how that lives in our brains, both, like, you know, it's not only three of, you know, we've got a much larger team that runs that. So documenting all that stuff in a way that can be followed without, you know, hand-holding from people that have been here a long time is really kind of like the next phase of what's going to enable growth, regardless of the model that we end up choosing.
And let's talk about the customer experience. For so many of us, the range of customer experiences when we make a phone call ranges from talking to someone who can't really speak English after having to go through 9 steps of a phone tree. My guess is that you're doing something different.
Exactly. Yeah, we pride ourselves on customer service. We're very proud in terms of what that looks like. The results show we have perfect. We have a perfect 5-star ratings in all 7 locations that we operate in. So we're very proud that we've scaled the customer experience from what was very mom and pop in the early days to people still have the same incredible experience, no matter where you're picking up the van and no matter what time of year. Specifically on the phones, we have a team that answers the phone 7 days a week. They speak incredible English. They're all local. They're one of that you'll probably speak if you call. There's basically 3 people you might speak to in addition to the 3 co-founders. You might catch one of us depending on the day and time. But one of the 3 is actually she lives out of her RV and travels with her husband. They are fully in this kind of nomadic RV lifestyle. And it's those kind of people, whether or not, you know, she's unique in the fact that she's actually living in an RV, but everybody else shares such a deep passion for sharing the experiences that, you know, outdoor experiences, that, you know, getting out into the national parks and just spending time outdoors with the people you love is an important part of all of our lives. And that's certainly what you'll hear on the other end of the line.
We just spent a few minutes chatting with Kevin Dineen of Motera Luxury Camper Van Rentals. Kevin, thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment.